So the Ordinance of Covenanting, we're up to the 15th part. This is actually part 3, Covenanting and First Obligation, part 3. And the fourth term of communion, public social covenanting, is an ordinance of God obligatory on churches and nations under the New Testament. So we're going to finish talking tonight about the obligation covenanting confers, and I want to take up several different questions regarding this. I want to discuss a distinct obligation of covenants, in just as an aside, as we look at this again. Want to talk briefly about the formal reason of covenant obligation, and then we're going to talk about several conclusions we can draw based on the idea that covenanting confers obligations. And finally, and again briefly, we want to talk about the principle that's involved in this. What is it about this that makes us look at this and say, yeah, this confers obligation? So, the first question then, do covenants have a distinct obligation peculiar to themselves? And what we're talking about does the covenant, the oath, the vow, do these things create an obligation distinct from, apart from, and in a sense corresponding to the law of God? So the answer to this, the short answer is yes, and we know this, the covenants possess an obligation distinct from God's law, from a number of places. We're going to begin looking at Ecclesiastes 5, verses 4 to 6.
Ecclesiastes 5, verses 4 through 6. When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Better is it that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin, neither say thou before the angel that it was an error. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thy hands?
Yeah, so the covenant or the vow is a distinct obligation. It constitutes a distinct and peculiar obligation from that of the law of God. Okay, we're going to talk about why, but we need to understand that there is then, for the covenanter, there is this parallel obligation. It's also a corresponding obligation to the moral duty demanded by the law. Because we've talked about this, we're not going to take a vow, we're not going to enter into a covenant to do something apart from or contrary to the law of God. So, there is an obligation to do the will of God as commanded. The law has a direct and immediate force. It commands and demands obedience to God as a dependent creature, right? You're a dependent creature. You need to render an obedience as a dependent creature, recognizing your inferior status to the Creator. The law requires that. But a covenant is an additional obligation. The covenant is brought under an additional obligation to do the will of God. Look at Leviticus 19, verse 12.
Leviticus 19, verse 12. And ye shall not swear by my name falsely, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am the Lord.
Yeah, we are not to swear by the name of the Lord in a manner that is false. We're not to take God's name in vain. We are, in fact, in all of our vowing, our covenanting, we are to have respect to the law of God. We are to take in the concerns of the law of God. And we are to pledge an obedience to the law of God. That's what we're doing. So whereas the law creates an objective demand, an obligation that is objective to the creature, the covenanter is not bound merely by the naked authority of the divine word, but by his own voluntary act. Look at Numbers 30, verse 2.
Numbers 30, verse 2. If a man vow a vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth.
There is then a self-subjective owning of that obligation in a vow or a covenant. Whereas the command is this external imposition, a covenant or a vow is, in fact, the taking up of that obligation voluntarily. Now, this is one of these things where, the law binds us to to perfect and complete obedience at all times and all places. And we're going to talk about this more in a few minutes. But the covenant is a recognition, subjectively, of something which is objective. The obligation that is taken up is actually an obligation that is pre-existent to the covenanter and objective to the covenanter. But once you conscientiously take cognizance of this obligation and pledge appropriate action in conformity to this obligation, you are adding an additional obligation to this. So that the covenant doesn't bind to anything additional to what the law of God contains, but as I said before, it additionally binds. And it superinduces a new and different obligation. Deuteronomy 10, 20.
Deuteronomy 10, verse 20. Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God, him shalt thou serve, and to him shalt thou cleave and swear by his name.
You're commanded to serve God. When you agree to that command, you are adding to that the additional bond of your consent. Right? You may be a rebel against the law of God. You may not consent to it. You're a rebel. You will not have this man reign over us. And, you know, the curse is pretty clear. You're going to perish because he has the right and the authority to rule over mankind. should you voluntarily come under this obligation, you do it by vow or covenant. And that makes you a covenanter. All right? If you break that, you know, having given your consent to have this man, Christ, rule over you, you break that consent, you're a covenant breaker. Right? You're no longer a rebel. A rebel is someone who is in stated opposition. Someone who is occupying a contrary stance. A covenanter is someone who is consenting and pledging allegiance for someone to do that. There's an added obligation. It's a different obligation. And it's subject to its own curse, if you will, if you break that. Okay, there's a difference in the way you treat an enemy on the combat field and the way you treat someone who commits treason. Right? There is, in the case of someone who commits treason, that person in their memory, normally these people are stripped of all dignity, and they are they're treated with total disdain and dishonor. So as in the case of an oath, there's this additional binding. Look at Exodus 22:11.
Then shall an oath of the Lord be between them both, that he hath not put his hand unto his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept thereof, and he shall not make it good.
Right, so the obligation to tell the truth is universal and perpetual. Right, you should tell the truth. The command is what? Thou shalt not bear false witness. But an oath brings the person who swears under an additional obligation. That you're not allowed to lie. It's against the law of God. But when you come under an oath to tell the truth, what you're doing is this. In terms of an oath or a vow, you are disarming, in a sense, the other side. You have now said, I swear that I'm going to tell the truth. Right? You have put the other party in a position of trusting you. That's not the case necessarily where someone just asks you, you did this or that happen. People are going to be, they're going to tend to want to test those kind of claims. But when you come under an oath, it's expected you're telling the truth. We've talked about oaths and vows some weeks ago. And there's an appeal to God, and there's an appeal, in a sense, to Judgment Day. And so there's a thought that such a person wouldn't dare tell the truth. But wouldn't dare lie, excuse me. If you do, we view that as something very serious. because you brought yourself under an additional obligation. So get 2 Corinthians 1:23.
2 Corinthians 1:23. Moreover, I call God for a record upon my soul, that to spare you, I came not as yet unto Corinth.
I call God as to a record of my soul, to take a record of my soul. That's Paul taking upon himself an additional obligation. He's appealing not only for something in the moment, but he's placing that moment really against Judgment Day. So, before he took the oath, if he deviated from the truth, he was guilty simply of lying. Now, however, he's guilty of what we call perjury. Look at Leviticus 5:1.
Leviticus 5:1, and if a soul sin and hear the voice of swearing and is a witness, whether he hath seen or known of it, if he do not utter it, then he shall bear his iniquity.
Yeah, so before he violated only the authority of God, now he violates both the authority of God and the obligation of his oath. So get 2 Chronicles 6:22-23.
2 Chronicles 6:22-23. If a man sin against his neighbor, and an oath be laid upon him to make him swear, and the oath come before thine altar in this house, then hear thou from heaven, and do and judge thy servants by requiting the wicked, by recompensing his way upon his own head, and by justifying the righteous, by giving him according to his righteousness.
Yeah, so in the first, you know, you're flaunting the authority of God, but you're not agreeing to it. In the second, you're agreeing to the authority of God, and you're flaunting it. Right? It's a matter of acknowledging or not acknowledging that authority and the obligation that that authority entails. The covenanter is acknowledging the obligation. Now, he's doing it because there is a blessing promised to those who keep covenant with God. But there's an additional curse on those who have, having pledged, you know, in order to get that blessing, then are duplicitous. Right? Just like when you take an oath to tell the truth. You do that in order to avoid perhaps having your entire life ripped apart. Right? So that they don't have to rip your life apart to discover what is the case. The fact is that once you've taken that oath, you have agreed then to tell the truth. If you violate that trust, you're subject to all of the penalties of lying, plus a much more harsh sentencing, because you basically agreed to tell the truth in order to avoid all these other unpleasant things, and now it turns out you violated that trust. Not only are you going to get the penalty for the lying, but you're going to incur much more grievous results as penalty for this perjury. The obligation of God's law must never be examined. We can't. His law is above everything. But in order to know its meaning and extent, we can. We can acknowledge, or we can examine it in that sense, but we can't examine it in the sense of questioning its authority. right? We, there's nothing there for us to look at. There's nothing there for us to consider. It's the divine authority. And we're required to bow before that. Look at Psalm 119, 33 and 34.
Psalm 119, verses 33 and 34. Teach me, O Lord, the way of thy statutes, and I shall keep it unto the end. Give me understanding, and I shall keep thy law. Yea, I shall observe it with my whole heart.
Yeah, but vows, oaths, covenants are different. All vows ought to be tried in their matter and manner. And we do that by the law of God in order to know whether or not they're lawful and binding or not. So they don't have that intrinsical display of authority. But they do have a distinct authority once we have tried them according to the Word of God. Look at Isaiah 8:20.
Isaiah 8:20. To the law and to the testimony, if they speak not according to this word, it is because there is no light in them.
Right. So we have a different kind, and we're going to see this again as we go through this. It's a different kind of obligation from the law of God. It's a distinct obligation from the law of God. The obligation of the law of God, we cannot search that out. The obligation of the law of God is in the will of the lawgiver, and that is inscrutable. The rationale of vows, on the other hand, that is different as to matter and manner. They have to be compared to the law of God. So these are subordinate things to the law. And yet, these are the things which not only make the law subjectively meaningful and capable of bringing blessing, but it's a dual-edged sword, because it also makes it possible to incur additional condemnations, curses, because there's additional guilt. And that's because there's a distinct obligation. And we're gonna see this, as I say, in a moment. We'll see it a little bit more. So let's look at the second question here then. What constitutes the formal reason of covenant obligation? So, let's consider the formal reason of the obligation of the law of God for a moment. The formal reason for obligation to the law is simply the bare authority of the lawgiver, God. As a result, everyone who is created falls under that obligation. But with covenant obligation, it's different. It's a personal act of the covenanter which constitutes the formal reason why a duty, when sworn to, is binding as a covenant duty and not the obligation of the divine law or morality of the act. In other words, we're going to treat it as a distinct kind of obligation. Yes, you're to do the right thing because it's the right thing. That's the obligation of the law. But the obligation of the covenant is because I agreed to do the right thing too. Let's look at Leviticus 27, 2 and 8.
Leviticus 27, speaking to the children of Israel and saying to them, when a man shall make a singular vow, the persons shall be for the Lord by thy estimation. Verse 8, but if he be poorer than thy estimation, then he shall present himself before the priests, and the priest shall value him according to his abilities, that vowed shall the priest value him.
Yeah, and here, the very fact that the priest is able, without getting into what exactly is in view there, I don't want to get into that right now, but the very fact that the priest is going to differentiate between one person who's covenanted or taken a vow and another person, that tells us that it's a different kind of obligation than the obligation of the law. Because the law binds all people to perfect obedience at all times and in all places. It doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter whether you're smart or dumb. Doesn't matter whether you're fat or thin. Doesn't matter if you're white or black. Doesn't matter if you're old, young. It really doesn't matter. The law binds universally everyone in every place at all time. But here we have, in Leviticus 27, a discussion of a vow. And this vow, the vow is being evaluated, weighted, and valued according to the capacity of the covenanter. And that tells us that it's the personal act of the covenanter which is constituting the formal reason why that sworn to duty is a covenanted duty or not. Okay, it's different. It's a different obligation. So, were the morality of the duty the reason of covenant obligation, then all mankind, wouldn't matter who you are, where you're from, what language or country, wouldn't matter. All mankind would be formally covenanters, because the reason extends unto all. Right? The law of God extends to everyone. The moral law binds every man. Look at Romans 10:5.
Romans 10:5. For Moses described the righteousness which is of the law, that the man which doeth these things shall live by them.
The law, the moral law, binds everyone from Adam to the last person that will ever live on earth. Right? From creation to judgment day, everyone who exists upon the earth will be bound by that moral law. You, me, everyone who hears my voice, everyone who doesn't hear my voice, which is far more, everyone is bound by that. Whether they want to acknowledge it or not, they're bound by it. The reality does not change because you don't want to acknowledge it. I know that's hard for a lot of people today to accept, and postmodernism fights against that idea. But reality is objectively true. It is inextricable. It's not simply your interpretation. Your interpretation of a bulldozer, if it doesn't include the fact that if it's coming at you, it's going to grind you into the pavement, then your interpretation is clearly beside and outside of reality, and it's not true. It doesn't matter how much you want it to be, and it doesn't matter how much you're offended if I tell you that's what's going to happen if you try to ignore it. It's objectively the case. So, covenanting would be useless and carry no obligation in it at all, for it doesn't affect the morality of the duty. Right? Whether we covenant or not, the morality of the duty remains the same. It's the same before as after covenanting. Look at James 2, 8 to 12.
James 2, 8 to 12. If ye fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, ye do well. But if ye have respect to persons, ye commit sin, and are convinced of the law as transgressors. For whosoever shall keep the whole law, and yet offend in one point, he is guilty of all. For he that said, do not commit adultery, said also, do not kill. Now if thou commit no adultery, yet if thou kill, thou art become a transgressor of the law. So speak ye, and so do, as they that shall be judged by the law of liberty.
So, covenanting cannot add anything to the morality, the intrinsic morality or immorality of an action or thought or what have you with respect to the moral law of God. And if it only if it bound wherever there was a morality of a duty, there'd be no distinction, there'd be no difference between the morality of duty because of the law and the morality of something as a covenant or sworn to duty. It'd be the same. It would be the same thing in estimation, which we've already seen. It clearly is not. So whereas God's law binds all men, whether they will or not, you can see this in Ezekiel 20, 11, 13, and 21.
Ezekiel 20, verse 11.
Yeah.
And I gave them my statutes and showed them my judgments, which if a man do, he shall even live in them. In verse 13, but the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They walk not in my statutes, and they despise my judgments, which if a man do, he shall even live in them. And my Sabbaths they greatly polluted. Then I said, I would pour out my fury upon them in the wilderness to consume them. Verse 21. Notwithstanding the children rebelled against me, they walked not in my statutes, neither kept my judgments to do them, which if a man do, he shall even live in them. They polluted my Sabbaths. Then I said I would pour out my fury upon them to accomplish my anger against them in the wilderness.
So God's law binds all men, whether or not they want it to. Vows, on the other hand, bind none, but such as take them, together with those whom they represent in the taking of that deed. So look at Deuteronomy 5, 3 and 29, 14 and 15.
Deuteronomy 5, verse 3. The Lord made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us, who are all of us here alive this day.
Deuteronomy 29, verses 14 and 15. Neither with you only do I make this covenant and this oath, but with him that standeth here with us this day before the Lord our God, and also with him that is not here with us this day.
So again, the formal reason for covenant obligation is the personal act of the covenanter on behalf of himself and any and all those whom he represents in the taking of the covenant. And in just in terms of that idea, it's something which the Reformed churches have always accepted. That idea, particularly we see it, the acceptance of that idea in the doctrine of infant baptism. So this isn't a place to defend infant baptism, but the doctrine of covenanting, if you understand it, provides more than a sufficient ground for defending the doctrine of infant baptism. And the fact that the church historically, from its inception, has baptized infants, tells you that the Christian church, from its inception, has, in fact, at some level, they've understood this doctrine of covenant obligation and how it's conferred. All right. Question three. And here's where we're going to get into some maybe some difficult points or some things that maybe at first don't seem as obvious, but hopefully as we go through this it will become more apparent as to why, in light of what we've been talking about for the past couple of weeks. Question three, what conclusions might we draw concerning the obligation which covenanting confers? Well, there are several things we should conclude. All right, the first thing that we need to consider is this. Covenanting, this in light of all the stuff we've been talking about in the last couple weeks, covenanting entails obligation on the unbeliever who vows and swears. Now, why were we saying that? We're going to look at an example here in a moment, but why can an unbeliever who vows and swears be said to enter into this obligation? Well, for two reasons. First of all, it's distinct from that obligation of the moral law, which binds everyone. Second, because an unbeliever can still engage in that personal act which confers the obligation. Look at Genesis 21, 27 and 32.
Genesis 21, verses 27 and 32, verse 27. And Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them unto Abimelech, and both of them made a covenant. And verse 32. Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. Then Abimelech rose up, and Phicol, the chief captain of his host, and they returned into the land of the Philistines.
And so if we were to take a time out and go off into a separate topic of discussion on this point, we could say this. It's for this reason why we are, in fact, allowed to enter into covenants of commerce or economic covenants with unbelievers. All right. Whereas we are not allowed to enter into these covenants of association or anything where we begin to get into matters of religion. But it is possible to have commerce in the world. Right? Else we'd have to be taken out of the world. We're not allowed to go into business with unbelievers, but we can do business with unbelievers. We can't form corporations with them that would involve entanglements. But we can form agreements of commerce with them, where the entanglements are limited to what we would call an economic exchange. That's what we see Abraham doing here with Abimelech. And there's even some pledge of peace that can go on in this regard. Right, between two parties or more. All right, unbelievers can covenant, and they're bound by them. But because that is the case, we need to be very careful about the kinds of covenants which we would engage in or with respect to unbelievers. And for more on that, I would recommend reading George Gillespie's essay on unlawful confederacies. He actually deals with this quite well and explains what is and is not permissible. He does so in very short compass. I've covered some of this some time ago when we talked about voluntary associations. Anyway. If this weren't the case, right, that it could engage or entail obligation on the unbeliever, then no command of God would be binding on the wicked. Right? Because the fact is, they're not going to acknowledge anything anyway. So if they acknowledge some obligation, that's better than none. Look at, for example, Proverbs 28:4.
Proverbs 28, verse 4. They that forsake the law praise the wicked, but such as keep the law contend with them.
Yeah, such as keep the law contend with them. Yeah. God's command is binding on them. Right? The fact is, the moral unfitness of man and his state of nature, if no command of God could bind, it would shield him from the claims of God's law, and any ordinance of God might be abused with impunity. Again, contrary to, for example, the claim we find in Psalm 50, verse 16.
Psalm 50, verse 16. But unto the wicked God saith, what hast thou to do to declare my statutes, or that thou shouldest take my covenant in thy mouth?
So, moral unfitness doesn't shield you from the claim of the law. Right? If that were the case, then, you know, the only thing you would need to do morally to absolve yourself of any debt would be to get yourself in such great debt that you couldn't pay your debtors. Now, I know they allow declaration of bankruptcies today in cases like that, but the legal allowance is very different from the moral allowance in these kinds of situations. If you've sort of spent yourself into the poorhouse and you find yourself unable to meet your obligations, it's quite different from, you know, a catastrophic situation arising. You know, there's a moral culpability there, and that's what we're saying. Because man's state of nature, why is he morally unfit to keep the law? Because God created him that way? No. But because he sinned and fell into that state. All right, every law of God contemplates an immediate and an ultimate end. Look at Leviticus 18.5.
Leviticus 18.5, you shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man do, he shall live in them. I am the Lord.
Yeah, so what is the law of God contemplating? Well, there's an immediate end. So whether we go through this or that commandment, you know, thou shalt not steal, the immediate end is that there would be honesty in the dealings between men, for example. But the ultimate end is what? That you might have life. If a vow is made in sincerity, God will give grace to fulfill it in some measure. Look at Isaiah 57:15.
For thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabiteth eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell in the high and holy place with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite ones.
And on the other hand, if neglect in the supposed case follow, chastisement will be inflicted. So, for example, 2 Chronicles 33:23-24.
2 Chronicles 33:23-24. And humbled not himself before the Lord, as Manasseh his father had humbled himself, but Ammon trespassed more and more. and his servants conspired against him and slew him in his own house.
Yeah, so, you know, God, it's really a way of saying God gives grace to the humble, but he resists the proud. And if you humble yourself before God, if you seek to fulfill your covenant obligations, you are moving into the obedience of God. And by moving with that expectation, you have a reasonable expectation of an attendant blessing. God will bless you. On the other hand, if you do something else, then you know, all bets are off, right? You're gonna have chastisements, because God resists the proud. The vow is made deceitfully, otherwise, in which the wicked cannot make it, then a double obligation is contracted. Right? You have a twofold obligation if you make a vow deceitfully. There's an obligation to punishment for dealing falsely with God. So look, for example, at Isaiah 48, 1 and 2.
Isaiah 48, verses 1 and 2. Hear ye this, O house of Jacob, which are called by the name of Israel, and are come forth out of the waters of Judah, which swear by the name of the Lord, and make mention of the God of Israel, but not in truth nor in righteousness. For they call themselves of the holy city, and stay themselves upon the God of Israel. The Lord of hosts is his name.
Yeah, you've got an obligation to punishment because you've dealt falsely with God. If you take a vow, if you act in a deceitful manner. And then, on the other side, there's a debt of obedience because of submitting, though feignedly. There is a submission to an ordinance appointed by it. Right? So you've dealt falsely in it, but you've also engaged to an obedience. So you've come under the obligation. Psalm 81:15.
Psalm 81:15. The haters of the Lord should have submitted themselves unto him, but their time should have endured forever.
Yeah, so the result of it all is this. God will not accept the vows of the wicked. Look at Psalm 78:36-37.
Psalm 78:36-37. Nevertheless, they did flatter him with their mouth, and they lied unto him with their tongues, for their heart was not right with him, neither were they steadfast in his covenant.
But at the same time, he's going to claim what they vow, and he's going to punish them if they do not make it good. Ezekiel 17:15.
Ezekiel 17:15. But he rebelled against him in sending his ambassadors into Egypt, that they might give him horses and much people. Shall he prosper? Shall he escape that doeth such things? Or shall he break the covenant and be delivered?
Yeah, so the idea is this. God's not going to accept your feigned vow. A vow, remember, a vow is, among other things, an act of worship. If your heart is not sincere with God, he's not going to accept it as it is tendered. It's not acceptable worship to him. On the other hand, because you've taken hold of a covenant, or by vow you've taken hold of the ordinance of God, you have created an obligation, and God's going to hold you to that. And so you're either going to get whacked, or you're going to get whacked and then whacked again if you take a vow in a manner deceitfully before God, because he's not going to accept it. He's not going to bless it. But he's still going to require it at your hands. And if you don't do it, that's another level of guilt for which you're going to get hit. That you're going to pay the debt. You will pay the debt. And by the way, you know, this is actually a situation where you might not think that this happens a lot the first time you kind of run this over in your head, but a lot of people do this when they're in a jam. They swear to God that they're going to do X, Y, or Z. If God gets them out of this situation, they are going to, you know, reform their behavior. They're going to, they'll never do this, or they will do that. They have something that they've pledged themselves to God. And an unbeliever doing that is taking God's name in vain. But should God take them up on it and deliver them, they have an obligation to follow through, even though they did it in a manner that was taking the Lord's name in vain. In fact, first thing they ought to do is repent of having taken God's name in vain. Right? But they have an obligation to follow through. So Israel, though many of them did not enter into it with sincerity, were charged with breaking the covenant with God, which they professed to make at Sinai, and punished for the sin thereby contracted. Look at Deuteronomy 31, 16 and 17.
Deuteronomy 31, verses 16 and 17. And the Lord said unto Moses, Behold, thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, and this people will rise up and go a-whoring after the gods of the strangers of the land, whither they go to be among them, and will forsake me, and break my covenant which I have made with them. Then my anger shall be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them, and I will hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall befall them, so that they will say in that day, Are not these evils come upon us, because our God is not among us?
Okay, and we also have a similar case in that of Zedekiah. Yeah, he suffered for breaking the covenant which he made with the king of Babylon by oath. And this is, you know, should he have done this? Different question altogether, but he did. Right? Was the king of Babylon someone you should have been entering into covenant with? Probably not. But look at Ezekiel 17, 18 and 19.
17, Ezekiel 17, verses 18 and 19. Seeing he despised the earth by breaking the covenant, when lo, he had given his hand, and hath done all these things, he shall not escape. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, as I live, surely mine oath that he hath despised, and my covenant that he hath broken, even it will I recompense upon his own head.
Yeah, and here again is why, and we saw this before, in the case of the Gibeonites. The fact is that they lied. They, on their part, certainly entered into covenant with the Israelites feignedly. It was a mockery. On the part of the Israelites, there was also sin. They didn't really try the matter as they should have. They didn't really determine whether or not these Gibeonites were people of the land that they were forsworn of God to destroy. But now, now they've made this covenant with them, and they can't. And when they do, when Solomon treats them some 400 years later, the curse of God is hanging over their head and comes upon them during the reign of David. And there has to be a recompense made. They broke covenant. Indeed, it's the wicked alone who break the covenant of God. They never sincerely have entered into it. But their disregard of it, after having professed to accede to it, is represented as a violation of it, and over such impends a fearful woe. Look at Isaiah 24, 5 5 and 6.
Isaiah 24, 5 and 6. The earth also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore hath the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell therein are desolate. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left.
Right. So, when we have covenants, when we have these vows, we know it entails obligation even on unbelievers. Now that's important because, you know, one of the charges, for example, in the realm of, going back to the question of infant baptism, the Baptists would say, well, some of the children, maybe most of the children, never have faith. They're unbelievers. Wouldn't really matter. But because covenant obligation can fall upon unbelievers. It doesn't simply bind believers. Covenant obligation isn't binding you as you're a believer. It binds you as you are a covenanter, right? As someone who takes a vow or enters into an oath. All right, second, though some connected with the visible church do not engage in the duty of formal covenanting, they are not therefore free from covenanting obligation. Look at Jeremiah 11, 1 to 10.
Jeremiah 11, verses 1 through 10. The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, "Hear ye the words of this covenant, and speak unto the men of Judah and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And say thou unto them, Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, Cursed be the man that obeyeth not the words of this covenant, which I commanded your fathers in the day that I brought them forth out of the land of Egypt from the iron furnace, saying, Obey my voice, and do them according to all which I command you. So shall ye be my people, and I will be your God. That I may perform the oath which I have sworn unto your fathers, to give them a land flowing with milk and honey, as it is this day. Then answered I and said, So be it, O Lord. Then the Lord said unto me, Proclaim all these words in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, saying, Hear ye the words of this covenant, and do them. For I earnestly protested unto your fathers in the day that I brought them up out of the land of Egypt, even unto this day, rising early and protesting, saying, Obey my voice. Yet they obeyed not, nor inclined their ear, but walked every one in the imagination of their evil heart. Therefore I will bring upon them all the words of this covenant which I commanded them to do, but they did not them. And the Lord said unto me, A conspiracy is found among the men of Judah and among the inhabitants of Jerusalem. They are turned back to the iniquities of their forefathers, which refused to hear my words, and they went after other gods to serve them. The house of Israel and the house of Judah have broken my covenant which I made with their fathers.
When we talk about the church, We could talk about a nation as well here. We see in the case of Israel, there was formal covenanting that went on, for example, under Moses. And from time to time, there is a covenant renewal process going on in Israel as a nation and as a church. Not every generation does that. And yet every generation is bound by the covenant and or covenant renewals which have gone before. All right, they're not all formally covenanters. But they are all covenanters by reason of their accession to their connection to the societies, whether it's ecclesiastical or political, they're brought into the same relation, covenant relation, as the body. And we talked about this last time, that the body the body assumes obligation, and that obligation continues in the body as long as the body exists. So whether we're talking about a church or nation, as long as the parties in covenant continue, they're in duration, there's a persistence, that obligation will persist. So it's an obligation which falls upon all that are members of the body, whether or not they were themselves formally covenanters. That is, whether or not they subscribed some paper at Sinai with everyone else or not, or formally said, I do in that. All who are not in the communion of the true church are exposed to the wrath threatened against those who are far from God. Jeremiah 10:25.
Pour out thy fury upon the heathen that know thee not, and upon the families that call not on thy name, for they have eaten up Jacob and devoured him and consumed him and have made his habitation desolate.
Yeah, the heathen who don't know God are under his curse. Right? So, conversely, a connection with that church brings one under the obligation of that church. You don't come into the church, which is under obligation, any more than you're a member, a citizen of a nation, not in some sense falling under the obligation of that nation. All right, look at Isaiah 51:2-3.
Isaiah 51:2-3. Look unto Abraham your father and unto Sarah that bare you, for I called him alone and blessed him and increased him. For the Lord shall comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places, and he will make her wilderness like Eden, and her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness shall be found therein, thanksgiving and the voice of melody.
So I know there are questions we could get into as to, not some of these relations we enter into voluntarily, and really if we're not able to bear the obligation in faithfulness to obligations already upon us, and we shouldn't do it. This is one reason why, when it comes to matters of, say, citizenship, it's very difficult for us to take an oath of citizenship. There's a voluntariness in that. On the other hand, we enter into we're voluntarily assuming the debt or the obligation. But on the other hand, having found ourselves in certain connections where these obligations pre-exist us, the only way to distance ourselves from those obligations is through an explicit act of dissent, which is why in the political realm we don't vote, we don't take oaths of office, and so on. We're occupying a place of political dissent with respect to the magistrate. And with respect to the churches, we can't engage them in any way that would compromise our ability to fulfill the various and sundry things that are required in these vows which are upon us. Okay? So it requires, in a sense, a more active dissent when we're born into some of these connections. On the other hand, where we're not, we have an obligation to remain aloof, to stay back from them. The fact is, though, when we connect with the true church, we're under all the obligations of the true church. The vows of God are upon all received by baptism or the Lord's Supper into its communion, whether they're worthy members or not. Look at Psalm 56:12.
Psalm 56:12. The vows are upon me, O God. I will render praises unto thee.
Yeah, so the spiritual blessings, the ones promised to Abraham and to his seed, even to all the faithful, belong to the people of God therein. Look at Galatians 3:14.
Galatians 3:14. That the blessing of Abraham might come on the Gentiles through Jesus Christ, that we might receive the promise of the Spirit through faith.
And the reason is that all the duties incumbent on those to whom great and precious promises have been made devolve on them. So again, let's look at Isaiah 48:1.
Isaiah 48:1. Hear ye this, O house of Jacob, which are called by the name of Israel, and are Judah, and are come forth out of the waters of Judah, which swear by the name of the Lord, and make mention of the God of Israel, the non-truth, nor righteousness.
So what we see here is this. The church, in it, whichever generation, when Isaiah is writing, it's long after Jacob or Israel has been on the scene, right? Jacob died many, many years before, centuries. But the promises, the covenant, that all was not only to Jacob, but to his children and his children's children, his descendants, right? Both natural and spiritual. There is a descent, and they are taken into this. So that the not only do the promises devolve to them, but the duties devolve. So that all the oaths and vows, all the prior obligations that the church took upon herself voluntarily, they devolve to subsequent generations. Now, along with that, and along with this idea, is the idea that we have an obligation to adhere to, walk according to, uphold all of the attainments which have been made by the church in prior generations. And every reform, faithful enactment, every faithful pronouncement doctrinally, all of these things form so many pieces of that covenanted duty now. And we can't simply lay these things aside without laying aside the obligation of the church as a continuous body. If we're going to lay these things aside, the only way to do it is to declare ourselves something totally different from, apart from. And then the question is, so if we're different than this church, where do we find the promises that belong only to that church? So this idea of covenant obligation is very important to the integrity of the community. Until it's paid, every vow made by a member of the church, whatever be his character, he's under obligation to perform. So look at Psalm 119:106 and an example in 1 Samuel 1:11.
Psalm 119, verse 106, I have sworn and I will perform it, that I will keep thy righteous judgments.
1 Samuel 1:11, and she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid and remember me, and not forget thine handmaid, but will give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head.
So the fact is, until they're paid, all the vows vowed by those in the church of God who represented him in all time past are upon him. And anybody in the church comes under these obligations. It's Psalm 116, verses 14 to 19.
Psalm 116, verses 14 through 19. I will pay my vows unto the Lord now in the presence of all his people. Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. O Lord, truly I am thy servant. I am thy servant and the son of thine handmaid. Thou hast loosed my bonds. I will offer to thee the sacrifice of thanksgiving and will call upon the name of the Lord. I will pay my vows unto the Lord now in the presence of all his people. In the courts of the Lord's house, in the midst of thee, O Jerusalem, praise ye the Lord.
So The church has from time to time engaged in formal acts of covenant renewal. But it has not felt itself under obligation to do that necessarily in every generation. There are providential calls to that. Nonetheless, the church is under those formal, the bonds of those formal covenanters. Now, this is something we're going to discuss more when we get to talking about the National Covenant, the Solemn League and Covenant, and even the renovation of the covenants in Arkansas in 1712. But for now, understand that connection with the visible church, true Church of Christ, even if you're not a formal covenanter, doesn't mean that you are free from the covenanting obligation that exists, because it exists upon the body or the society. Let's move on to the third point, and this is an important thing to consider. It has, I think, great implications and great bearing on our condition today. And that is this. Third, a minority in a church or that in a nation are bound by the law, by the lawful public vows made by the whole body, even though the community as a whole may have cast them off. Look at Hosea 11:12.
Hosea 11:12. Ephraim compasseth me about with lies, and the house of Israel with deceit, but Judah yet ruleth with God and is faithful with the saints.
Take the example of Israel. After Solomon, the kingdom is rent in twain. The northern kingdom never, Ephraim, lives up to its covenant obligations. They're the majority. Right? So ten northern tribes. Does their apostasy, does their backsliding and apostasy, does that justify Judah in relaxing its stance or letting go of its covenant obligation? And the answer is no. And Judah struggles with this for quite some time. But we see them from time to time renewing covenant. Though a nation or a body professing to be a church, after having come under obligations to duty, were to resolve that truth is error or that duty is sin, yet such a resolution could not bind the community. Look at Hosea 4:15-17.
Hosea 4:15-17. Though thou, Israel, play the harlot, yet let not Judah offend, and come not ye unto Gilgal, neither go ye up to Beth-Aven, nor swear the Lord liveth. For Israel slideth back as a backsliding heifer. Now the Lord will feed them as a lamb in a large place. Ephraim is joined to idols. Let him alone.
Let's take the historical situation. Israel, the northern kingdom, Ephraim. Israel's called Ephraim sometimes. They've put up golden calves in Dan. They are swearing at, Hosea calls it Beth-Aven. He's talking about Bethel. But they are, they're swearing in a manner contrary to the covenant, the covenanted standards of the church and nation of Israel. Is Judah dismissed to go on and participate in that? No, they're warned against it. They're warned to remain faithful. They're warned not to allow the majority to redefine the terms of the covenant, to redefine what is or is not moral duty, or what is or is not covenanted duty. They have to resolve as their own community to remain faithful in the face of overwhelming apostasy in Israel. No authority whatsoever will dissolve the obligation of an oath. Look at Galatians 3:15.
Galatians 3, verse 15. Brethren, I speak after the manner of men. Though it be but a man's covenant, yet if it be confirmed, no man disannulleth or addeth thereto.
So it doesn't stand in human power. Once an oath has been undertaken, a vow has been made, a covenant has been contracted, no human authority is high enough to dissolve the obligation, provided it's lawful, provided it's lawful in its matter and manner, right? There's not going to be any human authority that can override that because it is done under the semblance of and conducted according to divine authority. So, when lawful covenant engagements are disregarded by a community, the excellence which gave it an attractive power is gone. Look at Ezekiel 16:59.
Ezekiel 16:59. For thus saith the Lord God, I will even deal with thee as thou hast done, which has despised the oath and breaking the covenant.
When there is a general obedience, when there's a general keeping of a covenant, just like in the case of the moral law, when the vast majority of people are doing it, it appears to be the attractive thing to do. When most people are doing it, most people are actually satisfied at a human level and find it to be not only permissible but acceptable and even the attractive thing, if you will, to do. Right? It's in a world where virtue is glamorous, it's glamorous to be virtuous. But in a world where vice becomes glamorous, being virtuous is no longer viewed as glamorous. That's what we mean. When the community generally casts off the obligation, anything that might have been there, humanly speaking, that might have made that the attractive course of action, that all disappears. That's all gone. It's swallowed up in the general malaise and disregard of the community. And when that happens, the glory is departed, and the degraded society, like the robe which once covered the living body, but is afterward cast off, is faded and corrupt. Everything about it becomes disdainful and distasteful. And look at what is happening in the realm of morality today. We see this going on as they try to change as morals and mores shift. Look at what is happening. But look at Isaiah 28:1-5.
Isaiah 28:1-5. Woe to the crown of pride, drunkards of Ephraim, whose glorious beauty is a fading flower, which are on the head of the fat valleys of them that are overcome with wine. Behold, the Lord hath a mighty and strong one, which has a tempest of hail and a destroying storm. As a flood of mighty waters overflowing, shall cast down to the earth with a hand, the crown of pride, and the drunkards of Ephraim shall be trodden under feet. And the glorious beauty which is on the head of the fat valleys shall be a fading flower, and as the hasty fruit before the summer, which when he that looketh up upon it seeth, while it is yet in his hand, he eateth it up. In that day shall the Lord of hosts be for a crown of glory and for a diadem of beauty unto the residue of his people.
Yeah, so what Isaiah's describing is, as Ephraim persists in this departure from its covenanted reformation, as they depart from God, the society itself becomes degraded, and it's what was once its glory is laid aside. It becomes faded and corrupt. It's like the diadem is taken off of them. It's like their adornments of, as a society, are removed, and they're shown to be really a corrupt and degraded society. The living principle embodied in some members of such a community behooves to become separate from it, and to show that indeed that body which came under obligations that are not exhausted is in succeeding times to exist in a new but glorious sphere. So look at 2 Corinthians 6, 17 and 18.
2 Corinthians 6, 17 and 18, wherefore come out from among them and be separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and will be a father unto you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty.
Yeah, if you think about what is happening in a dying society, and why we're to separate ourselves from the dying, you know, when the majority is departing and all of that, we have to think of them as it's a dying mass. And if we cling to that, we're going to die with them. We need to separate from them. Why? Well, because to us belongs this living principle that is embodied in this covenanting obligation and reality that pertains to both what it means to be the church and what it means to be a nation. It's not the enfolding form, then, right, which is really what all these outward adornments are that we see, like that robe being laid off, but the living, faithful body that is the care of the covenant. The covenant is in the care of the living body, not in the dying external husk. Look at Romans 9, 6.
Romans 9, 6. Not as though the word of God hath taken none effect, for they are not all Israel which are of Israel.
Yeah, they're not all of Israel. Not all Israel are of Israel. So as Israel dies, as that external, typical, shadowy thing is dying, the reality that comes by faith, that is coming into the fore. And we can say there's a similar thing going on in the world today. If there's a new world coming, there is a judgment day, right? But even before that, there's the millennium. There is, in fact, a period of triumph coming. If we align ourselves and attach ourselves and insinuate ourselves into the dying masses of the nations that are in rebellion, we're going to be cast off, shaken off, when they're shaken off. There is an up-and-coming living organism that is the church in all nations, and there is the living organism of each nation that will remain into the millennium that exists even now. And those that's where we want to be situated. We want to find ourselves there. And that's why we don't want to join in covenant with and get ourselves entangled with this dying mass. It's dying. Just as much as in you, there's a new man and there's an old man. The old man is dying. It's eventually going to be laid in the grave with your body of flesh. And the new man will emerge from the grave on that final day in a new body to inhabit a new heavens and a new earth. There's a similar thing going on in history. And as covenanting societies, it behooves us to continually move ourselves and position ourselves to be in that living principle, no matter how small it may seem to be from time to time. So each member owes a debt of covenant duty. Look at Revelation 3:12.
Revelation 3, verse 12. Him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out, and I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which cometh down out of heaven from my God, and I will write upon him my new name.
The fact is, though apostasy may paralyze the body, so that by it as a whole, that obligation may not be felt, let that which lives therefore act in fulfilling it, even through a disruption and consequent reorganization. In other words, you know, if they don't feel the covenant obligation, it's because they're paralyzed in their apostasy. Whether we're talking about a church or a nation in that condition. We, on the other hand, ought to act in a manner directed toward fulfilling it, even if it causes disruption and requires consequent reorganization of the church. Look at Galatians 6:16 and Revelation 3:4.
Galatians 6, verse 16. And as many as walk according to this rule, peace be on them and mercy and upon the Israel of God.
Revelation 3, verse 4. Thou hast a few names, even in Sardis, which have not defiled their garments, and they shall walk with me in white, for they are worthy.
Yeah, the fact is that the peace that Paul commands to the Galatians is on those who walk according to the rule. It's not upon everyone who calls himself by the name of Israel, or by the name of the church, but those who walk according to the rule. Devotedness to duty, then, will be visited with an energy which will increase in the face of every difficulty. Look at Isaiah 59:19-21.
Isaiah 59:19-21. So shall they fear the name of the Lord from the west, and his glory from the rising of the sun. When the enemy shall come in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord shall lift up a standard against him. And the Redeemer shall come to Zion, and unto them that turn from transgression in Jacob, saith the Lord. As for me, this is my covenant with them, saith the Lord. My spirit that is upon thee, and my words which I have put in thy mouth, and shall not depart out of thy mouth, nor out of the mouth of thy seed, nor out of the mouth of thy seed's seed, saith the Lord, from henceforth and forever.
Yes, yeah, so to flee individually from obligation is to share the wholesale ruin of the whole unfaithful mass, only in order to be taken and fall, each one personally, for his iniquity. And we can either run toward it, we can run away from the obligation. If we run away from it, we're just going to end up falling and finding ourselves being ruined in iniquity. Look at Revelation 3:15-16.
Revelation 3:15-16. I know thy works, that thou art neither cold nor hot, and would thou wert cold or hot. So then, because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth.
All right, fourth point, fourth thing we can conclude, is covenanting does not implicate or compromise conscience. All right, I'm going to talk about this in a little bit more detail in this point, but we need to consider. Look at Galatians 5:1.
Galatians 5, verse 1. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage.
Yeah, so by this, what is intended is this. The exercise of covenanting, right, does not bring under any obligation to do what is evil or to abstain at any future time from modifying the engagements made so as to render it more and more perfect. In other words, there's nothing about covenanting that you can say, I have a conscientious objection. Because you're not being asked to do anything unlawful, nor are you being bound to anything in the future, which is anything but what is lawful and what is more and more conducive to what is lawful. All right? Covenant is not keeping you from further reform, but it is binding you from deforming. But it's also binding you from doing what's evil. So look, for example, in contrast, Acts 23, 12 and 14, but also Proverbs 4, 18.
Acts 23, verses 12 and 14. Verse 12, and when it was day, certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. Verse 14, and they came to the chief priests and the elders and said, we have bound ourselves under a great curse that we will eat nothing until we have slain Paul.
Proverbs 4, 18. But the path of the just is as a shining light that shineth more and more unto the perfect day.
Okay, so it's admitted, even contended for, that the exercise of covenanting brings under obligation. However, its obligation is only to duty. Right? You're not, covenanting is not bringing you under an obligation to something which is not duty. And remember, duty is what is due. Hence, duty. Look at Ezekiel 20, verse 37.
Ezekiel 20, verse 37, and I will cause you to pass under the rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant.
Yeah, and it's also important to understand that the duty is not to be abandoned because it cannot be properly performed. You don't not try because you can't do it perfectly. Right? If it's a duty, you're still to do what you can. Jeremiah 31:32.
Jeremiah 31, verse 32. Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was an husband unto them, saith the Lord.
Yeah, if not being able to properly perform, if that was a reason for abandoning covenant obligation, covenant duty, for the same reason every other obligation might be disregarded. Matthew 6:12.
And forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors.
Yeah, why are we praying that? Because everything. We're continually sinning. Right? Just because we sin, we fall short again and again of the law of God, doesn't release us from the obligation of the law. Just because we don't perform perfectly or maybe even adequately at times, doesn't release us from covenant duty. No covenant engagement is perfect. We know that. Remember, this is something which can be and ought to be brought to the bar of the Word of God and tried, both as to matter and manner. 1 Kings 8:46.
1 Kings 8:46. If they sin against thee, for there is no man that sinneth not, and thou be angry with them, and deliver them to the enemy, so that they carry them away captive unto the land of the enemy, far or near.
Yeah, so every covenant engagement, we are going to fall short, right? We're not going to rightly conceive all of our obligation. We're not going to, we will not undertake the fulfillment of all of our obligation voluntarily, because we can't even really conceive of it properly, given where we are as fallen and sinful people. So it's not going to be perfect. Either it's matter or manner, each of these then may have many defects. James 3:2.
James 3:2. For in many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, same as a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body.
Yeah, but the fact is, our covenants are going to fall short of that. Yeah, it's true. Were one to vow all the duty unfolded in the Scriptures, the engagement would be sound. Look at Psalm 119:96.
Psalm 119:96. I have seen an end of all perfection, but thy commandment is exceeding broad.
The problem is, we do not yet perceive all of the duty unfolded in Scripture. We don't get it all. We're approximating it. Now, the path of the just shines brighter and brighter to the perfect day. So the idea is that over time, we should, the church, the faithful church, the true church, should be perceiving more and more of that. The approximation should get closer and closer to the totality. But this side of glory, will we attain to that? There's no reason to think we will. So here's what we need to remember then. God's law binds all men to absolute perfection and holiness. Look, for example, 1 Peter 1, 15 and 16.
1 Peter 1, 15 and 16. But as he which had called you is holy, so be ye holy in all manner of conversation, because it is written, be ye holy, for I am holy.
God's law binds to absolute perfection. And of course, the only one who's ever satisfied that standard is Christ. Right? By covenanting, our vows do not bind us to absolute perfection, but to the most sincere and strenuous endeavors we can, by the grace of God assisting us. So the law is binding us objectively, but covenanting is us taking hold of, binding ourselves to God, promising with his assistance to do what we can by his grace. But Psalm 44, 17 and 18.
Psalm 44, 17 and 18. All this has come upon us, yet have we not forgotten thee, neither have we dealt falsely in thy covenant. Our heart is not turned back, neither have our steps declined from thy way.
In other words, we are dealing sincerely. We are striving to endeavor to do what we can by the grace of God. But we are still woefully inadequate because we are still in this body of sinful flesh. By covenanting to do duty, then, we're neither foolishly nor sinfully committed. We're not being held to do something sinful, and it's not a foolish committing of ourselves to do that which we can't do, because that's not what we're doing. We're not binding ourselves absolutely, binding ourselves to do what we can by the grace of God. Okay? Exodus 24, 7.
Exodus 24, verse 7. And he took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people, and they said, all that the Lord hath said will we do, and be obedient.
Yeah, what they're doing is what? With the book of the covenant, they're saying, all the Lord said we will do, and be obedient. Absolutely? No. We don't believe in sinless perfection. Sincerely? Endeavoring by the Spirit, that is, by the grace of God, to do what they can? Absolutely, yes. In that sense, yes. We ought to make every lawful endeavor, then, to perform duty. And yet our best efforts to serve God, we need to understand, are but approximations. That we're never keeping the law in its totality, even when we are keeping the law. It's just really an approximation. Colossians 3, 23 and 24.
Colossians 3, verses 23 and 24. And whatsoever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not unto men, knowing that of the Lord ye shall receive the reward of the inheritance, for ye serve the Lord Christ.
Yeah, it's an approximation. We are offensive in many things, right? We're falling short in many things. We're not attaining to the fullness, but then we're not relying on our obedience to merit our salvation. Nonetheless, we are making every lawful effort to perform our duty. God's law then binds all men to absolute perfection forever. It's Psalm 119:160.
Psalm 119, verse 160. Thy word is true from the beginning, and every one of thy righteous judgments endureth forever.
But in contrast, our vows bind only to that which is proper in this present life. Our vows are binding us, in a sense, provisionally and approximately, to what God objectively is binding us to do perfectly and forever. Romans 7:2.
Romans 7, verse 2. For the woman which hath an husband is bound by the law to her husband so long as he liveth, but if the husband be dead, she is loosed from the law of her husband.
Right. So, again, the vow is off. When we die, the covenant obligation comes to an end. When the society or the one of the parties in a covenant, when they come to an end, the society dissolves, then that covenant obligation comes to an end. Right? But the church is never going to dissolve between now and Judgment Day, and God, of course, is not going to disappear off the scene. You know, it's possible that nations will come and go. But the people in those nations are not quite so simply absolved of obligation. That's something we'll talk about more, Lord willing, in the future. But anyway, this is for the present life. Right? Covenanting is not something that's going to be looking beyond the present life. Whereas a law, God's law, is always what is right and wrong for men. All right, finally, that men are bound by previous descending covenant obligations is no reason why they should not themselves engage in covenanting. In other words, just because you are already bound doesn't mean you shouldn't renew covenant. You shouldn't engage in covenanting. Look at Psalm 105, 8 to 10.
Psalm 105, verses 8 to 10. He hath remembered his covenant forever, the word which he commanded to 1,000 generations, which covenant he made with Abraham and his oath unto Isaac, and confirmed the same unto Jacob for a law, to Israel for an everlasting covenant.
Yeah. Have not all the chosen of God to be brought successively nearer and nearer to him? Isn't it important that they are brought successively nearer and nearer? Right? And the answer is yes, and that's why men ought to covenant themselves in succeeding generations, even though there are descending obligations. Look at Isaiah 45:23, and we'll see a bit of this.
Isaiah 45, verse 23. I have sworn by myself, the word is gone out of my mouth in righteousness, and shall not return, that unto me every knee shall bow, every tongue shall swear.
Yeah, every tongue shall swear. So it's a means that God has appointed for everyone, to bring everyone closer and closer, whether you do it individually, or the church does it corporately, or nations do it corporately. This is something that is, in fact, a duty that's set before us and something for our benefit. And so, while not every generation necessarily engages in covenanting corporately, not everyone in each generation is formally involved, yet there is really a call for everyone at some time or other to engage in this sort of thing, that you enter into covenant. There's a reason why a lot of the Puritans at the beginning of the new year, they would write out a covenant for the year. They're aware of this. It's a way of bringing you personally nearer and nearer to God. In this case, that we're talking about, it's a way to bring the church, and in the case of national covenanting, a nation, into greater and greater nearness to God. Right, covenanting is a means, then, of the restoration of men to him from every imperfection, whether in an unconverted or a converted state. Jeremiah 4:4.
Jeremiah 4, verse 4. Circumcise yourselves to the Lord and take away the foreskins of your heart, you men of Judah and inhabitants of Jerusalem, lest my fury come forth like fire and burn that none can quench it because of the evil of your doings.
Engaging in it, and when men engage in this covenanting, they're described, in fact, as returning unto God. So look at Jeremiah 4, 1 and 2.
Jeremiah 4, 1 and 2. If thou wilt return, O Israel, saith the Lord, return unto me. And if thou wilt put away thine abominations out of my sight, then shalt thou not remove. And thou shalt swear, the Lord liveth in truth, in judgment, and in righteousness. And the nations shall bless themselves in him, and in him shall they glory.
Yeah, so throughout their lives, believers will be imperfect and will be called upon then to use this means of attaining their expected end. So, for example, in Isaiah 56, 4 and 6.
Isaiah 56, verse 4. For thus saith the Lord unto the eunuchs that keep my Sabbaths, and choose the things that please me, and take hold of my covenant. In verse 6, also the sons of the stranger that join themselves to the Lord, to serve him, and to love the name of the Lord, to be his servants, everyone that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it, and taketh hold of my covenant.
So covenanting is, in this sense, is a means of restoring men from every imperfection. And so as covenants take a more expansive view, as they begin to take in more and more things doctrinally and practically, they're going to be very much useful in promoting the sanctification of the people of God, the purity of the church, and through the purity of the church, promoting the purity of the church, you're promoting the peace of the church as well. The obligations entailed from the past bind to the duty, to covenant. Get
Psalm 132:12. Psalm 132, verse 12. If thy children will keep my covenant and my testimony that I shall teach them, their children shall also sit upon thy throne forevermore.
In fact, we know that the very first obligation, voluntarily accepted by personally or socially discharging it, binds additionally to it. Look at
Psalm 103:18. Psalm 103:18, to such as keep his covenant and to those that remember his commandments to do them.
So every new performance thereof adds to the motive to engage in it again. Psalm 89:34.
Psalm 89:34. Verse 34. There we are. My covenant will I not break, nor alter the thing that has gone out of my lips.
Yeah, and what happens then, each new performance of covenanting adds to the motive to covenant again, or to renew covenant, and instead of the obligation to covenant being diminished by the doing of the duty, it rather increases. Right? Why? Because the more you know something is going to work in bringing you closer to God, the more you are going to understand that this is something that should be done more often. Okay? Get Psalm 56:12 again.
Psalm 56:12. Thy vows are upon me, O God. I will render praises unto thee.
Yeah, the covenant obligation increases the obligation to covenant. Even as you are, in fact, fulfilling the covenant, should that be the case, the very process of fulfilling the covenant is, in fact, instructing you to covenant more. Right? To be more fastidious about your covenant engagements. All right. I want to just close with a brief question. Question four, then. Upon what principle may we conclude the conferred and descending obligation of covenants? What's the principle behind all of this? And I alluded to this a couple of weeks ago, but I want to make this clear. The principle in question is founded in the right which parents And we can say in the case of churches and nations, spiritual parents or national parents have to represent their posterity in certain social transactions. And we see it assumed from the very beginning of God covenanting with his people in Genesis 17, 7 and 8.
Genesis 17, verses 7 and 8. And I will establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed after thee and their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. And I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God.
And it is supposed in the continued identity of societies throughout successive generations. Look at Joshua 24:3.
Joshua 24:3, and I took your father Abraham from the other side of the flood and led him throughout all the land of Canaan, and multiplied his seed and gave him Isaac.
Yeah, so look at when Joshua's talking to the children of Israel, he talks about Abraham as if he was just their father. Well, that we're going back hundreds of years, centuries. But he mentions it as the rationale for what's going on now. Why? Because there is a continued identity in the society so that they can call Abraham father as much as Isaac could. It naturally enough follows then from the common interest which children have along with their parents in those objects for which federal deeds are framed. There's a common interest that parents and children should share. If you don't share these common interests, you have to ask yourself whether or not you really belong to that society. Whether we're talking about a family or a church or a nation. Psalm 78:3-8.
I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord, and his strength, and his wonderful works that he hath done. For he established a testimony in Jacob, and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God, and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and might not be as their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright, and whose spirit was not steadfast with God.
It's for this reason that churches and nations either grow and develop out of families, or families become absorbed into the churches and nations of others. Right? Cohesion and identity, common interest, all of that comes together. And, you know, we're to cast our and find our common interest where the church is. And we're to look to the church as to be the founding and the place where the nation begins. And that's why all of our industry, all of our endeavors, our activities should begin with and have reference to that core. Because out of that, we're looking for something new. We're not just looking to be participants. And we're certainly, unless we want to cast off the hope of our inheritance here, on the other hand, we don't want to hitch our carts to the horses of a bunch of people who are leading the church and or the nation in a different direction than the direction that God is asking us to covenant. So there are common interests which are shared between parents and their children. Again, whether we're talking about natural, spiritual, national, they have common interests, and the federal deeds are framed to that. Now, in this case, then, representation springs not so much from choice as when men appoint their civil and ecclesiastical functionaries, but from the appointment of God, from a divinely authorized constitution, a constitution the existence of which is distinctly recognized and clearly admitted by God himself. We're talking particularly about the way this transmits from parents to children, naturally, because it does so within church and state. Look at Hebrews 7, 9 and 10.
Hebrews 7, verses 9 and 10. And as I may so say, Levi also, who receiveth tithes, paid tithes in Abraham, for he was yet in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him.
Yeah, there is an obligation conferred because there is, in fact, a constitution divinely authorized when God makes to spring from the loins of one the person of another. You don't have any control over that. You can't control. You can choose who your friends are. You can't control who your parents were. And there is an obligation. And that obligation is doubled and tripled when that obligation is, in fact, conformed to the covenant obligations of the people of God. So that's what we're talking about. This, there is a natural foundation for asserting this idea of covenant, conferring of covenant obligation. We're not just pulling this out of the air. All right, with all of that in mind, the next time, Lord willing, what we're going to begin looking at is the idea of covenanting and how it was provided for in the everlasting covenant.